more varied than any landscape was the landscape in the sky, with islands of gold and silver, peninsulas of apricot and rose against a background of many shades of turquoise and azure. You're listening to Western Worlds. Welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University, just 10.4 light years from Epsilon Eridani B in London, Ontario, Canada. Tonight's quote is attributed to Cecil Beaton and evokes the metaphor of stars as isolated islands in a vast sea of space. Emphasizing that image is our musical selection, Sea of Stars, by Oceans Apart. Around many of those stars in the vast and infinite ocean we now know are the shoals that are planets. The very first was found in 1992, and there are now orders of magnitude more planets known outside of our solar system than inside of it. In the last 20 years, our understanding of solar systems in the general sense has increased in leaps and bounds, and so have our techniques to search for these places. Fascinatingly, each technique is sensitive to a particular kind of world. We have learned that some of these planets are dangerous reefs, tortured gas giants that have ventured too close to their parent star. We call these planets hot Jupiters, and while they may not offer shelter for future travelers, even at a distance we can begin to probe their atmospheres and their origins. We find these places through a technique known as radial velocity. We actually look for the wobble in the parent star caused by the titanic struggle between these objects. Other planets are located in a so-called Goldilocks zone, close enough for warmth, but not so close that they're burnt by their solar campfire. These places are the best hope of finding life outside of our Earth, especially if the bodies are super-Earth-sized or smaller. These more distant and often smaller bodies are best detected using something called the transit method, where we observe the light coming from a star and look for the dimming that occurs when a planet passes in front of its solar disk. But still other planets inhabit calmer waters, far from their parent stars. In some cases, these bodies can even be imaged directly, much as planets in our own solar system are. That kind of photography is the business of tonight's guest, Travis Barman, an astronomer at the Lowell Observatory in Arizona who makes a living through the precise science of images, much as Sir Beaton did. Our own Parshati Patel sat down with Dr. Barman recently to discuss his work to find and understand these extrasolar planets.
Dr. Travis Barman here, who is an astronomer at Lowell Observatory, Flagstaff, Arizona. Thank you very much for talking to us today.
My pleasure.
So, as everyone knows, there are more than 750 exoplanets that have already been confirmed, and more than 2,000 candidates are still lined up to be confirmed, all thanks to the Kepler mission. Would you mind to briefly describe the general methods that we use to detect these extrasolar planets?
Sure. Probably the one people are most familiar with is the radial velocity technique. And that method takes advantage of the fact that when planets orbit their star, they tug and pull on that star very subtly and causes the star to wobble back and forth in addition to its regular motion through space. And so with precise spectroscopy, you can measure that velocity shift and infer the presence of an unseen planet. Another technique is the transit method, which you mentioned with the Kepler survey. And that transit method looks for periodic changes in brightness of a star as a planet passes in front of it. Now, that alone doesn't tell you there's a planet there, because there are a lot of things that cause periodic brightness changes in stars. So to confirm candidates from the transit method, you still need the radial velocity technique. Another method is the microlensing technique. So when massive objects pass between an observer and a distant star, that gravity of that object can lens the light. And if there's an additional asymmetry in that object, perhaps caused by the presence of a planet, the lens will change from a pattern with a star with no planet. So you can infer the presence of a planet that way. And then lastly, another technique is the direct imaging method, which is more or less self-explanatory. You take a direct image of a star and look for a faint companion next to it.
Okay, so you're more involved in direct imaging and adaptive optics. So would you like to tell more about it?
Right. So the only discoveries of planets that I've been involved with is through the direct imaging technique.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that works is you use a really big telescope, like the Keck telescopes or Gemini, for example, gives you a big aperture, and an infrared camera, like NERC-2 or NIRI on Gemini, NERC-2 is on Keck-2, and adaptive optics, as you mentioned. To spatially resolve a planet that's next to a star, by spatially I mean on the sky, you need to be able to separate a really faint planet from its bright star. You need to correct for all the distortions that are created by not only the atmosphere, but also imperfections in the instrument and its optics. So the adaptive optics takes care of the atmospheric effects, and then we use a lot of high contrast imaging techniques, many of them pioneered by Canadian astronomers, David Lafernier in Montreal and Christian Marois at HIA.
So you were part of a team which included three Canadians, as you mentioned, who first directly imaged not only one, two, but four planets around the extrasolar planetary system HR 8799. So how did this all happen? Would you like to describe a bit?
So that's a really fun story. So with direct imaging surveys, you are taking images of lots of stars. And when you use high contrast imaging techniques and adaptive optics, invariably you find lots of faint things next to other stars. But 99 times out of 100, they're just background objects and not physically associated with the star. So in these campaigns, you have a lot of disappointment. A lot of things that look exciting that don't. So I was involved with a survey that was started at UCLA and included Bruce McIntosh and Christian Marois and Eric Becklin and a whole host of other people. And I came in sort of partway through that project. And at this point, we were finding nothing. Nothing but background objects, no planets so far. And we were getting close to the end of the survey. And most of our targets were focused on solar-type stars, like the Sun, F, G, and K-type stars, and where RV surveys and also transit had been very productive. But we more or less ran out of good targets for direct imaging in those types of stars, and so we had shifted to more massive stars. It had become somewhat clear from the RV surveys that more massive stars tended to have more planets around them, so we were shifting in that direction. And so we were focusing on A-type stars. And after observing just a few A-type stars, we came across this really good candidate, which was HR 8799. And the way you confirm candidates is you observe the same star with the same, preferably with the same instrument, 1 year later, and see if they're both moving together across the sky, which means we refer to that as common proper motion. And while in a year you may not see very much orbital motion, that common motion across the sky is more or less proof that they're bound. So HR 8799 had two really good candidates. And usually when we see more than one, it's almost definitely a cluster, or not a cluster, but a number of background stars. And so I remember being at the telescope, and many of us were sort of pessimistic about this. But Christian Marois, to his credit, was very optimistic. Somehow I have a sense that this one was going to turn out well. And sure enough, the next morning I came into the control room and Christian was sort of sitting there blinking between two images, from one from a year ago and the one we had taken the night before, and the planets weren't moving very much, which was a dead giveaway that they were moving. And a little bit of motion, we later realized was orbital motion we were seeing. And then, so that gave us one planet easily. The other one was there, but it wasn't quite, our confidence in that second one was not quite that high. But once you have one, of course, you're going to spend a lot of telescope time to understand it a bit better. Mm-hmm. And so the more times we observed that star, the greater the significance of that second planet. And then a third one started to appear. And so, wow, there's another one there. Could it? And many of us were like, no way, this is definitely not going to, this has got to be a background. And sure enough, it turned out to be real as well. And so we stopped at three. We thought that was pretty good and published the results. But Christian was convinced that he saw yet another one somehow hidden in there. And so we managed to get more telescope time through some improvements in the image processing. He was able to tease out this fourth planet. And there might be a fifth or a sixth or a seventh. There's plenty of room actually inside of the innermost planet, which is at 15 AU. So with new instruments, we might be able to see yet another planet in there.
Okay, so how did the media react to this, you know, finding so many planets around some other star?
Right. Well, the media went pretty nuts about it. This was arguably one of the first images of an extrasolar planetary system, and certainly the first images of a multi-planet system. And so this really got the media excited, and this was one of those few cases where they didn't have to call in the artist.
Yeah, you have the image.
You actually have the image. So they really liked that, and we had some movies that we put together that showed how the discovery was made, building of the signal-to-noise of each planet. Another thing that's somewhat, it's almost certainly coincidental, but the first planet found from the RV method is 51 Peg in the constellation Pegasus. The first transiting planet found is HD209458b, which sits just next to 51 Peg in the sky. And HRD799 sits just next to HD209458. So all of these firsts are just sitting there in this one little spot of the sky. So the media kind of liked that a little bit. Yeah, it was very popular.
So when you're direct imaging, what do you use? Like, what selection criteria do you use for stars? And what kind of planets, so like in terms of sizes, do you expect to see in direct imaging?
That's a great question. Almost all of the planet hunting techniques have some kind of bias. Radial velocities have bias because you need fairly short periods and to detect them, and you know you're limited to a certain mass that will tug enough on the star to give a signal. With direct imaging, the bias is, well, planets are very faint relative to stars, and so you're kind of, you know, fighting with, you know, trying to read the license plate on a car while staring at its headlights. It's very difficult. So the way you fight against that is by looking at younger systems. Planets that are younger, especially giant planets, are brighter when they're younger, and more massive planets are also brighter. So direct imaging is sensitive to young, massive planets. And by massive, I mean sort of Jupiter mass or greater. We typically stop calling something a planet around, well, some people stop at 13 Jupiter masses, but the RV surveys sort of look like that mass probably stops around 20-ish Jupiter masses. So anything from a Jupiter mass on up to maybe 20 Jupiter masses would be a legitimate planet candidate. So we look at young stars and hope to see young self-luminous planets. And they also need to be nearby because you need to spatially separate them from the star. They need to have high proper motion because in the HRD799 case, the fact that it's moving relative to other stars very quickly means we can do a very, very definitive test of common proper motion. If the star itself is moving very slowly, then it won't be that different from background. And so it's very hard to test for the common proper motion. So those are some of the criteria we use.
Okay, so you model the atmospheres of extrasolar planets. What techniques do you normally use to gather data from the extrasolar planets, and what are the properties you can infer from their atmospheres?
Okay, so the two primary kinds of data that we collect are photometric and spectroscopic. So, and this is true for all the different planets. And for giant planets that orbit very close to their star, we usually are limited to transiting planet systems to measure their fluxes in spectroscopy. And for For direct imaging planets, the great thing about them is when you image them, you immediately get a flux measurement of that planet, at least in one bandpass. They're much easier to follow up at different wavelengths than transiting planets, because many of the traditional, or at least more or less traditional, approaches that we would want to use are feasible for directly imaged planets. So spectroscopy and photometry of those we can do relatively easily. And then once we have those data, it's my job to try to infer some of the atmospheric properties. And I do that by using numerical models of the atmospheres of giant planets. And by that I mean we sprinkle in all the ingredients that we think are important for a giant planet atmosphere, hydrogen, helium, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and so forth, and then see what the chemical properties would be for a given temperature and pressure and what the spectrum would be like for those opacities. So common ingredients, common species would be carbon monoxide, water, methane. Those are usually the primary molecules that regulate the temperature structure, for example, and also what the spectrum and photometry looks like. So when we compare what the model predicts for the spectrum or fluxes in a given band to what we actually observe, then we can, at least to some level, conclude that the properties are similar in the simulation as they are in the real object.
So you also study the atmospheres for brown dwarfs. So for people who don't know what brown dwarfs are, would you mind to define or describe brown dwarfs and also tell us how the atmospheres are different from that of planets?
Okay. So brown dwarfs are often referred to as objects that are intermediate in mass between giant planets and stars. So stars burn nuclear fuel for a large fraction of their life and shine with a relatively constant brightness through most of their lives. Brown dwarfs can burn a little bit of nuclear fuel in the early stages of their lives, but shortly after that phase, they just cool with time and shrink and cool. And in terms of mass, we typically think of brown dwarfs as being around 75 or 80 Jupiter masses or less, and then start thinking about planets when we get down to about 13 Jupiter masses or so. The brown dwarfs lie in that range, sort of 13 to 75 Jupiter masses, and these are found free-floating in the galaxy, and they're also found as companions to other stars. And we now know, and they also, being much lower in mass than stars and also not burning nuclear fuel, they're very cold. They're much colder than stars. So recently, people have been finding brown dwarfs as cold as 300 Kelvin using the WISE mission, which is an all-sky infrared survey. The vast majority of brown dwarfs were found with near-infrared all-sky surveys, like 2 mass. And so brown dwarfs are quite abundant. And because they're cool, and they share a lot of things in common with giant planets, that low temperature means that similar molecules like water, carbon monoxide, ammonia, methane, and so forth, are also present in their atmospheres. And also, they probably share some of the same cloud-like properties. So when you get very cold, things start to condense out of the atmosphere, solid particles, and then eventually ices. So by studying brown dwarfs, we are probably learning a great deal about what the physics of the atmospheres of giant planets are like, and especially young giant planets, which are warm because they're young and they're still quite luminous. So there's a lot of overlap between brown dwarfs and giant planets.
Okay, so we can say brown dwarfs are more like a transition between planets and stars.
Yes. Some people used to refer to brown dwarfs as failed stars because they weren't burning nuclear fuel like a star. They just didn't have the mass. But I like to think of them as overachieving planets.
This leads us to what you have been in news recently, well, astronomically speaking recently, is you discovered water on an extrasolar planet, which was obviously important for all of us because everyone wants to look for life in the universe. So would you describe more of this experience of how you reached the conclusion of finding water?
Right. So, well, before I get into that, water is a very important ingredient for life, but primarily liquid water. Frozen water is not very conducive to life, and neither is gaseous, vaporous steam. And in this case, the discovery was of water vapor in a hot Jupiter, so very, very close to its star, less than a tenth of an AU, or one-tenth of the Earth-Sun distance, and to that star. And so that planet would never be very habitable. Now, in this case, water, which I mentioned before, is a very common molecule and plays an important role in shaping the structure of the atmosphere and also regulating well, the structure of the atmosphere in terms of temperature and pressure, and has an indirect influence on a lot of the other species that you might find in the atmosphere. So for me, the discovery had nothing to do with life, more about understanding more about the atmosphere of one particular extrasolar planet, and perhaps more generally about the others. So the way in which we identify water in this particular planet is by using transit observations. And transit observations are sensitive to the size of a planet. And since these are gaseous planets, they don't have solid surfaces. And gases absorb differently at different wavelengths. So at wavelengths of light where the opacity in the atmosphere is large, a planet will appear slightly larger than it would at wavelengths where the atmosphere is very transparent. And so if you can measure the transit depth at a variety of different wavelengths, so you're measuring the size of the planet at different wavelengths, that variation in size maps out the variation in opacities in the atmosphere. And so by looking at regions of light where water absorbs and doesn't absorb, you can measure the relative change in the planet size and infer something about the composition. And we can distinguish between water and, say, other species because they all absorb slightly differently at different wavelengths of light. Mm-hmm. And so by looking in a particular wavelength range, we were able to see that the planet got suddenly a lot larger at wavelengths of light where water absorbs and was smaller at wavelengths blueward and redward of that region. Mm-hmm. So that's how we infer the presence of water.
Okay. So other than water, what other elements did you find in this planet?
So I personally didn't detect any others. Other groups have seen sodium, for example, in the same planet at wavelengths. And this is in the optical wavelength range. Sodium is another element that, while not nearly as abundant as water in the atmosphere, strongly absorbs at a very distinct range of wavelengths. And so a group of astronomers led by Dave Charbonneau observed, who's Canadian, I think. So other elements that have been detected, atomic hydrogen, for example, absorbs very strongly in the ultraviolet. So Lyman alpha observations have been, Lyman alpha is a very strong line in hydrogen, and so hydrogen absorbs very strongly at those particular wavelengths. And so, and that's a really fascinating case because at those wavelengths, the planet looks extremely large, which is indication that the bulk of the planet is surrounded by gaseous hydrogen, and some of it's escaping from the planet. So some of the planets are experiencing mass loss. Other molecules that have been detected, carbon monoxide, for example, methane, and so forth.
Okay, so that brings us to what are you working right now on in terms of modeling the atmospheres of exoplanets?
In terms of the modeling, the primary thing is trying to understand the physics of clouds in the atmospheres, not only of giant planets, but also brown dwarfs. Clouds are very difficult to model, and in numerical simulations, we need to condense a lot of very complicated physics into things that can easily be simulated on modern supercomputers. And so we can't actually trace all of the microphysics and small turbulent motions and various aspects that form the clouds that we're familiar with in the Earth's atmosphere. So we need to develop theoretical models that capture most of the important aspects of clouds. Not all of the details, but at least the important aspects, meaning how they affect the temperature structure and the overall spectrum. So clouds and for hot Jupiters, since a lot of our information comes from transiting planets, they also sit very close to their star, and so strong winds are predicted on in their atmospheres because of the large day-night temperature differences. In planets that are spin-synchronized, they show the same face to the star all the time. And so this produces a lot of asymmetries in the atmosphere of the planet. And so I, along with some collaborators, are working on 3D radio transfer models of the atmospheres to try to make a better prediction for what's happening at the limb of the planet, for example, which is this transition region from day to night where perhaps a lot of activity is going on from winds and so forth.
Okay, and what about the direct imaging? What more we can expect from the direct imaging?
Right. So direct imaging is about to make, I hope, huge progress. There are three instruments that are dedicated to direct imaging. One is called the Project 1640 camera, which goes on Palomar. The other is the Gemini Planet Imager, which will be on Gemini South. And then a third one is a European instrument called Sphere, which will go on one of the VLT Very Large Telescopes. And they're all tailor-made to image planets in sort of the sweet spot where we expect giant planets to be, which is similar to our own solar system, so 5 to 20 AU or out to 30 or 40 AU. And so these instruments are all several orders of magnitude more sensitive than the instruments we have been using for direct imaging. And they probe this very special, or not special, but new range and separation from the star. So we expect several dozen new planets to emerge in the next couple of years, which doesn't sound like a lot considering the 750 planets that have been found so far. But these planets will be very special because they will be at separations that haven't been explored, separations from the star that haven't been explored before from radial velocity techniques. They'll be at much younger ages, billions of years younger than the radial velocity planets, for example. So I think we're going to learn a lot about planet formation, giant planet formation, the evolution of planets, and so forth, even from just a few dozen discoveries from these instruments.
Excellent. So thank you very much for such an informative interview today.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So we just talked to Dr. Travis Barman, who is an astronomer. We talked about a lot about exoplanets. And we know that Kepler mission currently, which is very active and has more than 2,000 unconfirmed planets. So what are your thoughts about finding more than 2,000 unconfirmed planets?
Well, I think it's definitely a very exciting time. Last year before February, they had, what was it, something like 700, I think. And then they increased that to 1,200. And now 1 year later, just in March 2012, they've increased it again. And now they're up to 2,300 potentials. So among those are something like 50 potentially habitable worlds where the water might be wet, and some of those are even rocky. We might be able to walk on them. And this is just beginning. We actually have too many now to easily check them all and do follow-up observations. So we're actually, there's quite a lot.
And that is a very good point, that these aren't confirmed extrasolar planets. The 2300 figure is the total number of light curves that look like they might correspond to a planet. And Kepler certainly had a lot of false positives.
Yeah.
They don't count these properly until they've been confirmed, usually by multiple methods, on the ground. And I think across all methods, not just Kepler, we've got 760 that have been confirmed as of today.
Which is a fantastic number because, you know, 20 years ago the answer was zero. Right, and now, you know, all of a sudden we have a variety of methods of detecting them that Dr. Barman described, and we have enough people looking at it that we're getting these candidates in batches of hundreds.
Yeah, and they're coming more rapidly every year.
Yeah, and of course, in the case of Kepler, now that the mission is getting longer, we can see candidates that have longer periods as well. So not just these hot gas planets that are orbiting in very, very close to their stars, but things that are farther out in the 360-ish day range.
Yes, we're getting very close to being able to find an actual twin of Earth, something with an Earth period, maybe Earth size.
That's a good point, because there was a statistical analysis of all the data that Kepler collected until now, and they said that Earth planets are really rare compared to what they're finding now. So obviously, having a longer mission would help in terms of finding an Earth-like planet.
I'm just amazed by all the different techniques that are out there. I mean, we started in 1992 with the pulsar timing method, and then in 1995 with radial velocity. I mean, something in those days, the idea of looking at transits was, we just didn't quite have the technology for it, but now we've got that, we've got direct imaging, which is what Dr. Barman does, and we've got gravitational microlensing. And the neat thing is each one of those techniques is, they're sensitive to different kinds of planets, so we can sort of fill in the gaps.
Yeah, and direct imaging especially is exciting because we get the actual pictures of these planets, real pictures in infrared generally, but certainly useful things to show to the public and to be able to show off rather than a light curve, which is a graph.
Well, this was unthinkable before, right?
You know, of course.
The whole idea that you know, the planet will reflect some light from the star, but it'll be tiny in absolute magnitude compared to the star that it's next to.
Yeah.
And so fine in angular separation that you would never be able to resolve it. But here they're finding some. They're in the very long periods, very, very large radius. But nonetheless, yeah, we've got a few of these planets that we're directly imaging, and he has plans to do more.
Which is very exciting, especially for the public, as you said, because they're not normally used to looking at the light curves. They would rather have a picture, beautiful picture, colored, which they would look at and say, oh, okay, so we really found one. Because as a scientist, you know what you're looking for, but you cannot explain it to the general public until you have like a beautiful picture to look at.
I think Dr. Berman was actually saying that this was his work. One thing he likes about it is that when you do the press releases, it's the one time when you don't need to get an artist's rendering.
Yes.
And all of the biases, of course, that will go along with that. And just when you mention things, because I know that you're very interested in a lot of the super-Earths, these almost habitable planets that may be in the habitable zones of stars, sometimes you can get a lot of license pictures that get drawn of those places. When really we know very little about them. We know the size of the planet. We may know how far it is from its star. And everything else is just based on models and conjecture.
Yeah, we can guess at the temperature, but without knowing the actual atmospheric conditions, we can't know really if the water on the surface is overheated or frozen solid. So even when we speak of a habitable zone, that's still guesswork. So any artist's rendering is always a little...
Speculation and imagination and hopeful thoughts.
They can be nice pictures, though.
Exactly. I mean, the equilibrium temperature for the Earth, it might surprise you to learn, is actually about 20 degrees below zero. It's just because we have an atmosphere here, and we have a certain amount of greenhouse effect, dare I say, that we have a habitable world with liquid water and a water cycle.
Yeah, and so that, you know, we're familiar in our solar system with where the gases are, right? But in each of these strange and bizarre planetary systems, there are hundreds of them, each one with a totally different makeup, with gas planets in different places and giant rocky planets. So what are the atmospheres going to be like? Where are the volatiles going to be? Where's the snow line? Very difficult to predict what atmospheres will be like and what of these sort of secondary temperature contributors will be. Now, of course, Berman talks about doing spectroscopy on the atmospheres of these planets when they transit, which can help to answer some of these questions. But there's a huge space of unknowns for each of these planets still.
But it is really nice with that spectroscopy. We can actually say for sure, yeah, there's water we've detected in the atmosphere of a planet that's light years away, and there is hope that we would be able to detect real signatures of life as well. So it's these planets are extremely far away, and yet we might one day be able to really know a lot about them, including possibly what's on their surface.
Yeah, is that not impressive to be able to tell which gases are in the atmospheres of which planet from light years away?
And to be able to tell how fast the winds blow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the unfortunate thing is that right now it's just the hot Jupiters that we can do this for, but as techniques get better, the sky's the limit.
Yeah, we have come a long way in the last 20 years, so maybe next 20 years would be more impressive.
Yeah, and of course everyone's just waiting to see when we'll find one of these with a large amount of oxygen in the atmosphere.
Undoubtedly. And one of the interesting things, you mentioned oxygen, you mentioned water. We're really headed towards life here. Mm-hmm. One of the great things with Kepler is because it's looking in a particular square, it's going to do a census for us.
Yeah.
So ultimately, sure, it's pumping out 23 candidates for exoplanets, but ultimately Kepler's main achievement will be in helping us pin down parts of the Drake equation that let us know how common things like planets are in the galaxy.
And they're turning out to be far more common than a lot of predictions would have guessed, so.
Yeah, we're just tripping over them all over the place where we look.
Yeah,
yes.
It's like 20%, I think, of the stars have planets, so.
Yeah, and we're going to refine those numbers the more we look and the longer, you know, Kepler and other instruments co-roll.
And I think the main idea of everyone behind finding such planets is to find life at the end of the day. That's probably everyone's goal. To look for a twin life somewhere else in the universe.
Yeah, there's another real utility, though, which is that, you know, up to about 20 years ago, we had, you know, fewer than I have fingers planets as examples of what planets look like. And we had one star system as an example of how those look. And now we have 700 examples of planets and almost as many star systems. And they all come in different shapes. They're all forming in different ways. And all of these very queer collections of bodies that we could not have imagined before. And we have to rethink the ways that star systems form and the way that, planetary systems happen.
That's a really good point, because until 20 years ago, we had this idea of how our solar system formed. But now when we look at the other ones, we know there are some missing gaps between what we have as in theory for now. And so hopefully this will be helping us to modify our theory and have it fit for all the multiple systems.
Exactly. It isn't just an advantage for, you know, that one term in the Drake equation where we, you know, find out how many planets are out there. It also tells us, you know, what is it about our own planetary system that makes it special?
Well, one thing is that the theory has always struggled to keep up with the observations. And so now that we are getting these more observations, of course, originally, as you were sort of saying, we thought that all solar systems would look like ours. And then we started to find hot Jupiters, and those were the first things we found because those are the easiest to detect. And so the theorists had to struggle to come up with, well, how would we get hot Jupiters? We don't understand where those could come from. Once we understood those, we no longer understood how we get Earth. And so once again, the theory is trying to come up with, okay, how do you get hot Jupiters and potentially Earths, mix them together maybe? And certainly the observations are telling us it seems that when we have rocky planets, we're not finding gas giants well close to the star. And so all this is feeding into the process of figuring out how all solar systems, all stellar systems might form.
There's also a point where what our solar system differs from is, like, our giant planets are far further out than what we are actually finding. So our theories need to provide a solid basis for having the giant planets so close to their host stars, or finding them so far, and now actually even finding nomad planets, which are just roaming around in the galaxy with having no host stars. So our theory needs to be modified enough to provide all different aspects of such multiple systems.
And this is really, we do the same thing in our own solar system as well. We can improve our understanding of things like fluid mechanics by going to a place like Jupiter, which is a beautiful laboratory for that sort of things. By looking at other planets in our own solar system, we understand our Earth better because we understand how things work with that variety of different perspectives available from those planets.
Yeah, we live on a planet. We spend all of our time on a planet. And if we want to understand planets, it's useful to look at more than one. And now we have more than 10. We're in an exciting time where we're able to be discovering exoplanets throughout the near part of our galaxy in large numbers with a variety of techniques, and we're able to confirm them by using more than one technique. And we have more and more of these capabilities coming online, and we're seeing the tremendous bounty and variety of these planets nearby. The universe is getting to be a more crowded and a more interesting place.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forrester and featured an interview by co-host Parshati Patel. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Dave Kirsch, Raymond Francis, Parshati Patel, and John Moores. Our editors were Parshati Patel, John Moores, and Michael Forrester. And, as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are Western-Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope that you can make world enough and time for Western Worlds again next week, right here on astronomy.fm. So